and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Is the lifting of more COVID-19 restrictions in Iowa on the horizon? Governor Kim Reynolds pointed to improving COVID-19 trend lines in hinting Tuesday she may be looking at lifting more restrictions on businesses and cultural amenities that she ordered closed in March to slow the spread of the potentially deadly virus in Iowa. During her daily briefing at the State Emergency Operations Center, Reynolds said Iowa Department of Public Health data show a dramatic rise in testing over the past few weeks, with the number of positive cases trending down and the number of individuals testing negative is trending up. According to state data, 1 in 29 Iowans have been tested for the coronavirus. Reynolds noted that 1 in 34 have tested negative, while 1 in 206 have tested positive, or roughly 14% of the 107,196 Iowans who have been tested since the state's first case March 8th. The continued bad news in Iowa's numbers, however, was that another 12 Iowans died from the respiratory ailment in the past day as of Tuesday morning, bringing the overall fatality count to 367 over the past 2 months. The 15,296 confirmed COVID-19 cases reported on the health agency's revamped website Tuesday morning were up 341 from Monday's data collection point. But more than half, 7,847, of the Iowans who have tested positive have recovered, according to data posted at coronavirus.iowa.gov at the time of Reynolds' midday briefing. Since May 1st, the governor has eased restrictions on a number of businesses. Malls, hair salons, restaurants, and gyms are among the businesses allowed to open under limits on their capacity and requirements for social distancing and sanitation. Other businesses await word on when they will become part of the move to reopen the state's economy. Currently, under the governor's emergency order, all bars, indoor theaters, casinos and gaming facilities, senior citizen centers and adult daycare facilities, bingo halls, bowling alleys, pool halls, arcades, amusement parks, museums, aquariums, zoos, indoor or outdoor roller or ice skating rinks and skate parks, playgrounds, swimming pools and spas, wading pools, water slides, wave pools, spray pads, and bathhouses are closed statewide until 11:59 p.m. May 27th. Reynolds indicated during her briefing that she has been discussing possible changes with various associations that have been proactive in reaching out to us and talking about the good practices they're putting in place to allow them to resume scaled back and restricted operations. "We're continuing to reevaluate on a daily basis," said Reynolds, who noted she planned to make an unspecified announcement Wednesday and follow that up next week with some other announcements as the emergency order reaches its deadline. "We know that it is important that we continue in a very responsible, safe, measured, phased-in manner to continue to open up. And what we're seeing from businesses and from Iowans, they also are being very responsible and thoughtful in how they are bringing their businesses back online," she said. "So it's been a great effort by everyone across the state, and because of that, we're continuing to see positive trends, and so we're going to continue to monitor that and look for opportunities to continue to bring more businesses online," the governor added. "The list is getting narrower all the time." While highlighting the positive trends Tuesday, Reynolds also lamented coronavirus outbreaks in 37 long-term care facilities and the 204 residents who are included among the 367 Iowans who have died in the pandemic. Officials with the State Health Agency, the Iowa Department of Human Services, and the Iowa National Guard said they are opening a temporary testing site Wednesday in Mason City to test staff from nursing homes in Cerro Gordo County. Also Tuesday, Human Services Director Kelly Garcia said state officials will start publicly identifying child care centers where there are outbreaks of COVID-19. If testing indicates an illness problem, a provider will be asked to close anywhere from 2 days to up to 2 weeks, depending on the number of children who are enrolled, for deep cleaning and other mitigation efforts, she said. According to state data Tuesday morning, there are 383 Iowans currently hospitalized with coronavirus-related symptoms statewide. Of those, 126 were in intensive care and 83 required ventilators. Polk County led the state with 3,128 positive cases and 83 deaths. Linn County has reported 73 deaths, followed by 33 in Muscatine County, 31 in Blackhawk County, and 18 in Tama County. State officials reported Woodbury County has posted 2,343 positive cases, followed by Blackhawk County with 1,628 and Linn County with 899. Linn County posted 3 of the 12 COVID-19 deaths reported since Monday afternoon, while Polk and Marshall counties each reported 2 deaths. Blackhawk, Guthrie, Jasper, Louisa, and Tama counties each reported 1 death. Ringgold County recorded its first confirmed case of coronavirus, leaving Decatur County in southern Iowa as the only one of Iowa's 99 counties to not have a known case. A total of 462,634 Iowans filled out assessments at the state's testiowa.com website. Health officials had conducted 12,069 serology tests that look for the presence of antibodies, which are proteins produced by the body's immune system to fight disease-causing bacteria or viruses. Cerro Gordo's daily COVID-19 update. For Tuesday, May 19th, data snapshot. 15,296 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Iowa. 17 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo. Age ranges of lab-confirmed cases, 18 to 40, 4 cases, 41 to 60, 7 cases, 61 to 80, 6 cases, 367 deaths in Iowa, 0 deaths in Cerro Gordo, 2,696 COVID-19 tests administered at the mobile testing unit. A status report of monitoring and testing of COVID-19 in Iowa provided by Iowa Department of Public Health can be found at coronavirus.iowa.gov. For Cerro Gordo County data, visit cghealth.com. The purpose of strike teams and the benefits of surveillance testing in our community. As stated yesterday, the Iowa Department of Public Health, IDPH, the Iowa Department of Human Services, DHS, and the Iowa National Guard are opening 2 temporary testing sites this week to test nursing home staff that work in facilities in Cerro Gordo County. A strike team will be assisting in the assessment and testing operations. There is no reason to be alarmed that a strike team is present in our community. The team allows more capacity for testing in a timely manner. The teams are designed to be supportive and assist in connecting facilities with any needs that are identified, such as PPE and staffing. The state is getting increased access to testing, allowing the state to be more proactive in mitigation of spread. Surveillance testing is used to gain a better understanding of the number of COVID-19 cases in a specific population, location, and point of time in hopes to stop the virus from spreading more. This initiative allows Cerro Gordo County to make sure that we are doing all we can to identify not only those staff that are infected to prevent spread, but also those that have been exposed and may have developed antibodies that lower risk of reinfection. To date, there have been no outbreaks identified in any LTC facilities within Cerro Gordo County. If you have questions, please call 641-421-9345. Introducing the expert panelists for the weekly COVID-19 press conference tomorrow. This week, the weekly COVID-19 press conference will have 3 panelists to discuss a variety of topics such as surveillance testing and strike teams in long-term care or LTC centers and reopening advice for restaurants and retail stores and a meaningful message regarding personal mental health during a pandemic. The first panelist is Dr. Samuel Stanton, the Executive Medical Director of the ABCM Corporation, who will explain the benefits to surveillance testing and what purpose strike teams serve. The second panelist is Jessica Dunker, President and CEO of the Iowa Restaurant Association, who will share her insights and tips for restaurants and retailers getting ready to welcome back customers. Pastor Dan Garriotz from Trinity Lutheran Church will be the third panelist, offering much-needed advice for leading a team and managing mental stress as we navigate our new normal. The weekly COVID-19 press conference will be held via Zoom and streamed live on the City of Mason City's and Cerro Gordo Public Health's Facebook pages at 3:30 p.m. on May 20th. To submit a question ahead of time, email E. Dunbar, and that's E-D-U-N-B-A-R, at cghealth.com. A recording of the press conference will be available on the City of Mason City's website at masoncity.net. JIC recommends businesses to take COVID-19 Economic Recovery Survey. While this pandemic is changing how we do business, we look forward to entering a new phase of recovery and growth for Iowa. Please take a few minutes to complete this new survey developed by the University of Northern Iowa's Institute for Decision Making and UNI's Strategic Marketing Services. The deadline to complete this survey is Friday, May 22nd at 5 p.m. This new survey is a follow-up to UNI's survey of businesses in mid-March. Participation in the survey is vital to state efforts to understand the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on Iowa businesses and organizations. IEDA will use survey results to inform public policy on recovery and growth, including potential resources for businesses. To take the survey, visit uni.co1, and that's the numeral 1, .qualtrics.com. Virus review. States accused of fudging testing data. U.S.-Canada border to remain closed. As large parts of the U.S. ease their lockdowns against the coronavirus, public health officials in some states are being accused of bungling infection statistics or even deliberately using a little sleight of hand to make things look better than they are. The result is that politicians, business owners, and ordinary Americans who are making decisions about reopenings and other day-to-day matters risk being left with the impression that the virus is under more control than it actually is. In Virginia, Texas, and Vermont, for example, officials said they have been combining the results of viral tests, which show an active infection, with antibody tests, which show a past infection. Public health experts say that can make for impressive-looking testing totals, but does not give a true picture of how the virus is spreading. In Florida, the data scientist who developed the state's coronavirus dashboard, Rebecca Jones, said this week that she was fired for refusing to manipulate data to drum up support for the plan to reopen. Calls to health officials for comment were not immediately returned Tuesday. In other developments, Canada and the U.S. have agreed to keep their border closed for another 30 days until June 21st, as Canadian leaders sought to reassure residents who fear a reopening. The U.S. has more confirmed cases and deaths from COVID-19 than any country in the world, though its per capita numbers are well below many other nations. More than 11 million people have been tested in the U.S. for COVID-19, all with the assurance that their private medical information would remain protected and undisclosed. Yet public officials in at least two-thirds of states are sharing the addresses of people who tested positive with first responders, from police officers to firefighters to EMTs. Facing the gravest U.S. economic crisis in decades, Treasury Secretary Stephen Mnuchin and Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell offered Congress contrasting views Tuesday of what the government's most urgent priority should be. Mnuchin warned that prolonged business shutdowns would pose long-term threats to the economy. Powell, by contrast, stressed that the nation is gripped by an economic shock without modern precedent, and that Congress must consider providing further financial aid soon. Coronavirus cases have been spiking in several populous nations, a clear indication that the pandemic is far from over. New cases are sprouting up from India to South Africa to Mexico, while Russia and Brazil now sit behind only the United States in the number of reported infections. Russia saw a steady rise of new infections Tuesday, and new hotspots have emerged. Health experts say the increasing attacks from U.S. President Donald Trump on the World Health Organization for its handling of the coronavirus could weaken global health. In a letter to the WHO on Monday, Trump threatened to permanently cut U.S. funding to the agency unless it commits to substantive improvements in the next 30 days. Critics say it shows a profound misunderstanding of the agency's role. U.S. officials say the USS Theodore Roosevelt will make a shorthanded return to sea later this week, nearly 2 months after the ship was sidelined in Guam with a rapidly growing COVID-19 outbreak. Navy Captain Carlos Sardiello tells the Associated Press The mission will include a scaled-back crew of about 3,000, leaving about 1,800 sailors on shore who are still in quarantine. There is no universal playbook for coronavirus testing in professional sports. Protocols and procedures, guidelines and handbooks, they could be as different as rule books. There's plenty of common ground, though, which explains why executives and doctors from various leagues have consulted with each other while moving closer to at least a partial return to competition amid a pandemic. North Iowa Band Festival announces Spirit Week activities. Let the North Iowa Band Festival festivities begin. Well, kind of. The North Iowa Band Festival Foundation, the nonprofit that organizes the annual downtown event, announced Tuesday that although the 2020 Band Festival has been canceled, the community can participate in Spirit Week activities from a distance. The Band Festival, which is traditionally held Memorial Day weekend, was canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic in mid-April. The daily Spirit Week activities will honor Mason City's rich musical heritage and incorporate a new version of traditional band festival entertainment. Meredith Wilson's birthday and the North Iowa Band Festival were celebrated on Monday with a tribute at Elmwood Cemetery, where Mason City High School drum majors Bailey Gunderson and Shay Theobald placed flowers at the gravesite and participated in a short program organized by the Mason City Chamber of Commerce. Chris Friends, who usually serves as the master of ceremonies for the festival, interviewed the 2019 North Iowa Band Festival King and Queen, Jacob Verhelst and Alana Noss, respectively. A video, which features the royalty's festival memories, has been posted to social media platforms. At 7 p.m. Wednesday, the band Brad Plus Kate, a musical duo scheduled to perform at this year's festival, will hold a virtual concert on Facebook Live. A big reverse parade is scheduled from 2 to 4 p.m. Thursday in front of the Commerce Center, 9 North Federal Avenue. The event will replace the traditional Saturday morning parade. Festival staff will distribute pre-bagged candy and commemorative buttons to cars traveling north in front of the building. Participants are encouraged to decorate their vehicles and drive slowly on North Federal Avenue, entering from West State Street. Participants must remain in their vehicle, and staff will be wearing masks and gloves. On Friday, local favorites Betty and the Gents, a frequent festival performer, will perform at 8:15 p.m. on Facebook Live. A special Music Man tribute set is planned that promises to knock your socks off. For more information, visit nibandfest.com or follow the North Iowa Band Festival Facebook page. State's COVID-19 strike teams coming to Cerro Gordo Wednesday and Thursday. Long-term care facility staff in Cerro Gordo County will be tested for COVID-19 on Wednesday and Thursday this week, part of the state's strategy to test all employees coming into contact with those most at risk to contract the virus. The strike team, opening two sites in the county, consists of representatives from the state departments of Health and Human Services and the Iowa National Guard. The testing offered by the strike team is for long-term care facility employees only and not the general public. "We are definitely on board with that," said Michael Davis, administrator at IOOF Home and Community Therapy Center. Neither staff nor any residents at IOOF facilities have tested positive for COVID-19, Davis said, and he believes that's due to the vigilance of his team. "The threat is so low here that they, the state, focused on the pokes and the counties first," Davis said. IOOF has also ordered kits for all its residents, and those tests will be administered soon, Davis said. They will be processed within 48 hours by LabCorp. Good Shepherd's director of nursing, Kate Byerly, also confirmed her staff will be tested this week as well. She also noted there have been no cases of COVID-19 contracted by staff or residents in her facilities either. Byerly attributed Cerro Gordo County avoiding the outbreaks that have struck facilities in Cedar Rapids and Des Moines to the attention residents here paid to the safety guidelines. "We also take the rules very seriously," Byerly said. "If someone has a cold, they're sent home and they stay there for 7 days. The Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services also make it impossible for long-term care facilities to keep information about the health of their residents and staff from families. Recently released guidelines now require facilities to contact families if a small number of residents or staff have an upper respiratory illness, even if it's not COVID-19. Notification for anyone who contracts COVID-19 is an automatic, and if more than 3 residents or staff come down with the illness, the state considers it an outbreak. With the rapid increase in those tested in Cerro Gordo that will come with Wednesday's and Thursday's work, will more than likely also come a spike in the number of those who test positive in the county. That's not a reason for alarm, however, according to Cerro Gordo Public Health. Surveillance testing is used to gain a better understanding of the number of COVID-19 cases in a specific population, location, and point of time in hopes to stop the virus from spreading more, according to CG Public Health's Tuesday press release. This initiative allows Cerro Gordo County to make sure that we are doing all we can to identify not only those staff that are infected to prevent spread, but also those that have been exposed and may have developed antibodies that lower the risk of reinfection. To date, there have been no outbreaks identified in any long-term care facilities within Cerro Gordo County. Mason City Police Department sends pig crying, "Wee, wee, wee," all the way home. On Tuesday morning, the Mason City Police Department had an unexpected task to attend to. The task? Corralling a loose pet pig. The lucky fellow was spared from the market and safely returned home. Clear Lake School Board looks to adopt a lion logo. The charging lion or the sideways lion? That is one of the questions the Clear Lake Community School District Board of Education is trying to answer. It's not just about football. That's not why we're doing this. I also looked at the wellness center and some of the things we're going to have to do later on and what's that cost going to be, Superintendent Doug G. told the school board at its May 12th meeting. If we're going to change it, now would be the time to do it. The school board has been discussing the district's brand, including its logo and color scheme, since residents approved an $18 million bond referendum in March that green-lighted projects at Clear Creek Elementary, Clear Lake High School, and the Lions Field Athletic Complex this summer. Another project included in the referendum is the $10 million Health, Wellness, and Recreation Center, which is being done in collaboration with the City of Clear Lake. The district, in partnership with Jostens, sent out surveys to parents and staff earlier this year for feedback related to its current branding. G said the survey revealed that people are equally passionate about whether the charging lion or the sideways lion should be the district's official logo. That sentiment was echoed in a phone conversation between district administration, school board members, coaches, and booster club members last week. Both logos are used throughout the district in buildings, signage, uniforms, and more. The survey also showed that tradition is important to Clear Lakers, G said. Jostens also created modified logos for the district, but none of the school board members expressed interest in them. G said the district selected Jostens for this phase of the branding process because it was a free service the company provides to school districts that already do business with them. "I personally like what we already have in place versus any of those new ones," said Mike Moeller, school board member. "I didn't like those new ones at all, but that's me, and I'm indifferent on one of those old ones, whether it's the sideways lion or the charging lion. I like both of those." Board President Cheryl Bergvig said she liked the charging lion more. G said the district asked Jostens to come back with a modernized charging lion logo, but the company likely won't be the one to complete the branding process with the district because that's not its niche. Jostens is a Minnesota-based company that is primarily known for its production of high school yearbooks and class rings, as well as championship rings for professional sports. School board member Tony Brownlee said the district's brand should be defined, clearly communicated, and consistently used because it's the face of the district. "We're doing a lot of change, we're doing a lot of facilities, and we ought to have consistent branding, and that word is really important," he said. "It's not just a logo, right? It's everything. It's how we write our names. It's how we describe things. It's the colors that we need for jerseys and shirts. And it is a logo or multiple logos." The discussion about the district's logo has gained traction in recent weeks because construction at Lions Field began. Dean Snyder Construction of Clear Lake was able to start work nearly a month early because of the discontinuation of in-person classes and the cancellation of the spring sports season due to COVID-19. Dean Snyder Construction of Clear Lake was awarded the contracts for the Clear Creek Elementary Secure Entrance Project for $515,230 in March and for the Lions Field Athletic Complex Improvements Project for $2,443,900 in April. Part of the $2.4 million Lions Field bid includes a $10,900 alternate to have the district's logo included on its new turf football field this summer. "My belief is we are doing this because the district needs to do it right," Brownlee said. "We are not going to make a decision on the football field, but it sure feels like we're hustling pretty hard to try to get the football field done." G said the school board can choose to have the turf field laid without a logo, but if it decides to add one later, it'll likely cost an additional $10,000. The decision needs to be made before June 1st to have the logo included on the turf. Perhaps more important than the district's logo is its color scheme, more specifically the yellow shade or number it wants to use throughout the district because its end zones and sidelines are yellow, he said. Dale Ludwig, Clear Lake High School assistant principal and activities director, said he's been working with the district's architect and area businesses to acquire color samples so the school board can make a decision. He said the district has used an array of yellow shades throughout the years. If the district decides to change its logo entirely or modify the Charging Lion, the high school gymnasium and other areas will need to be redone to reflect the change, and that is a costly experience, Ludwig said. "It's not a drop in the bucket. It's pretty detailed, and it takes a lot of time and effort to get it done right," he said. G said he and Ludwig have put together focus groups comprising students, teachers, and community leaders to gather input related to the district's brand this week. No-bid Iowa vendor charged with felony in assault on woman. A longtime Republican donor and campaign vendor was awarded millions of dollars in no-bid contracts to supply personal protective equipment to Iowa's executive branch, despite facing a felony charge alleging that he brutally beat a woman. David Greenspan, owner of Competitive Edge, Inc., is charged with willful injury, causing serious injury in the November 25th altercation at his West Des Moines mansion. Police allege that he kicked and struck the 37-year-old woman repeatedly in the head and face, chipping her front tooth and bruising her ribs. The woman, who was on the floor and intoxicated, recorded part of the alleged attack on her cell phone. Police arrested Greenspan, 63, 2 weeks later after reviewing the video. Greenspan has pleaded not guilty under a defense of property theory, arguing that he used appropriate force to remove a trespasser from his home. He allegedly told police that he slapped the woman twice to try and get her senseful when she would not leave, but that he didn't beat her. If convicted, Greenspan faces up to 10 years in prison. The state doesn't conduct criminal background checks when awarding contracts and was unaware of the allegations against Greenspan, said Department of Administrative Services spokeswoman Tammy Weinsek. The state checks on whether companies are in good standing, she said. The state awarded Competitive Edge 3 contracts in April to supply isolation gowns and goggles that would be used by healthcare workers to protect themselves from the coronavirus. They're worth $7.2 million and require his company to supply 1.1 million items in coming weeks. The contracts were awarded as Iowa rushed to rebuild its stockpile of personal protective equipment. Governor Kim Reynolds suspended competitive bidding requirements in March for goods and services needed to fight the coronavirus. State Auditor Rob Sands said Monday he's reviewing the contracts. Greenspan, whose company usually makes promotional items like T-shirts and campaign signs, has never supplied such equipment before. He said both products were being manufactured in China and would be non-medical stuff. "We aren't messing around with anything that's critical," he said. He said he wasn't sure who would use them, but they aren't medical, so they aren't going into surgery. They are clearly marked that way. The gowns are to be made of polyester and coated with polyurethane to provide fluid resistance and antimicrobial properties. The contract says they're for healthcare worker protection and are not sterile. Agencies awarding contracts can consider a vendor's integrity and reliability, past performance, and the best interest of the state, in addition to factors such as price and quality, administrative rules show. Felony convictions do not appear to be disqualifying by themselves. Greenspan's defense attorney, Rick Olson, said his client vigorously disputes the criminal charge. He said the case should have no bearing on Greenspan's business relationship with the state, saying he is innocent until proven guilty. "We don't think there's any merit to it," he said. "I've seen the video. There's not much there other than my client asking her to leave, which she doesn't do numerous times." Olson, a Democratic state representative, urged a reporter to investigate who the alleged victim is and what her history is. She was arrested for operating while intoxicated after leaving Greenspan's home. A hearing is scheduled for next week to determine whether Greenspan has the right to conduct in-person depositions of witnesses. A trial date hasn't been set because of the coronavirus pandemic. Federal records show that Greenspan donated $15,000 in February to Trump Victory, a joint fundraising campaign supporting President Trump's re-election and Republican groups. Greenspan has long been connected to Iowa Republicans, but he said that his ties didn't land him the state's business. He said Competitive Edge has supplied various items to state government, and officials called him unsolicited, seeking help acquiring gowns and goggles because he imports from China. The contracts were issued by the Department of Administrative Services and to be paid for by the Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. They came as Greenspan claimed to be struggling financially. On April 16th, Greenspan attested in a court filing that he currently had zero income. The claim came in a request to reduce his child support obligations to an ex-wife, whose attorney suggested in a recent filing that Greenspan uses business income for personal endeavors. Greenspan gave $2,500 to the Republican Party of Iowa's Federal Committee last year, records show. He has donated to several candidates over the years, including to the campaigns of Governor Kim Reynolds and U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. Iowa political campaigns have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars buying signs and other items through Competitive Edge since 2003, records show. Greenspan said in an interview last week that he was apolitical and didn't like the direction of the nation's politics. "It's a different climate these days," he said. "As a businessman, I don't like what goes on right now." You're listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Alvina Molitor. Born July 3, 1928, died May 12, 2020. Alvina Molitor, 91, of Floyd, passed away Tuesday, May 12, at the 11th Street Chautauqua Guest Home in Charles City with family by her side. A celebration of life mass will be held at a later date to be announced at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Charles City. A private family funeral service was held at Hauser Weishauer Funeral Home in Charles City, with Sister Diana Blong from Immaculate Conception Catholic Church officiating. The service was live-streamed on the Hauser Weishauer Funeral Home Facebook page and is still available for viewing. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery in Charles City. Alvina Lizzie Odens Molitor was born on July 3, 1928, at home in Sibley, the daughter of Henry and Lizzie Getting Odens. She was the sixth of seven children. On April 19, 1950, Alvina and Ernie Molitor were wed at Sibley. They raised five sons and one daughter. In 1958, they purchased a farm in Floyd and moved to the farm in 1968 after residing in Lamar's for 10 years. Her love was the farm, from helping Ernie with the farming, her beautiful gardens, and raising her children. She was a woman with many talents, including quilting, sewing, cooking, painting, and drawing. Alvina was a member of Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Charles City. She helped co-found the Charles City Hospice. Alvina managed the Charles City Mall for many years and also did the accounting for her son's business. Alvina is survived by her children, Gary of Floyd, Glenn and partner Charlene Drosty of Mason City, Mark and partner Lydia Pacheco of St. Augustine, Florida, Mary Ann of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Stephen of Jacksonville, Florida. Two daughters-in-law, Brenda Molitor and spouse Martin of Mason City, and Tammy Molitor and spouse Otto of Charles City. 18 grandchildren, 29 great-grandchildren, along with numerous nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband Ernie of 62 years, son James, grandson Canyon Molitor, four sisters, and two brothers. Alvina's priorities in life were her faith and her family. The family would like to express their gratitude to Alvina's healthcare provider and assistance provided by Hospice of North Iowa. Condolences may be sent to 628 6th Court Southeast, Mason City, Iowa, 50401. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to hospice. Eleanor Malloy Madden, born July 16, 1935, died May 16, 2020. Eleanor Malloy Madden, 84, of Mason City, entered the gates of heaven on May 16th, surrounded by her family at her home. A private mass of Christian burial will be Tuesday, May 19th, at Epiphany Parish Holy Family Catholic Church in Mason City, with Reverend Neil Manternack officiating. Interment will be at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery in Mason City. Visitation will be held from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. Monday, May 18th, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City, where a rosary will be led at 5:30 p.m., immediately followed by a scriptural wake service. In recognition of the loving care Eleanor received in her last days, the family requests that memorial contributions be sent to Mercy One North Iowa Hospice. Eleanor was born July 16, 1935, to Marcus and Beatrice Duffy Malloy in Clare. She attended and graduated from Joyce High School before attending and graduating from St. Joseph's College of Nursing in Sioux City, after which she received her registered nurse degree. She began her nursing career at Mercy Hospital in Mason City, where she spent over 50 years caring for patients. Her career and her life are a testament to her positive spirit, her kindness, and her devotion to others. Eleanor was united in marriage to Thomas Madden on April 7, 1956, in Holy Family Catholic Church in Mason City. They were blessed with three children. Her faith was very important to her. She was an active member of the Holy Family Parish and the Madonna Circle, delivering Holy Communion to parishioners unable to attend Mass. After retirement, Eleanor became a volunteer at both North Iowa Mercy Medical Center and Hospice of Northern Iowa. She enjoyed traveling, baking, reading, and going golfing with the Oak Hills Ladies Golf Club in Clear Lake. On Saturdays, she joined her regular coffee group and would often have lunch with other retired nurses. Eleanor loved spending time with her family and friends, and her ready laugh and quick sense of humor brought a smile to everyone's faces. Eleanor is survived by her husband, Tom, children, Ann Madden Rice, Stephen Joseph Madden, Lynn Westfall, and spouse James, grandchildren, Catherine Warnell and spouse Garrett, Charlotte Wheelidge and spouse Jeffrey, Cole Westfall and Amelia Westfall, siblings, James Malloy and spouse Betty, Mary Ann Brown, Sharon Rydeen, and Joseph Malloy and spouse Susan, in-laws, Jean and Joe Bamrick, and many nieces and nephews. She was looking forward to her first great-granddaughter's arrival in May. She was preceded in death by her parents, in-laws Russell and Bertha Madden, Joseph and Anna Lee Madden, Rosalie and Clay Woodhouse, John and Barbara Madden, Mary and Delbert Madden, Robert Rydeen, and Donald Brown, and daughter-in-law Dr. Deborah Jamison Madison. Waldorf Athletic Programs signed six new athletes. The Waldorf hockey team added some punch to its offense earlier this week with the signings of two new forwards. Morgan Sweeney and Luke Wright both signed on to play hockey for the Warriors this season. The two were teammates last year on the Minnesota Mullets of the United States Premier Hockey League. Sweeney finished third on the team in scoring, while Wright scored 8 points after joining the team in midseason. Sweeney is a 5'9" right-handed forward and played for the Mullets for two seasons. He scored 19 points for the team in 2019-2020. "We are very excited that Morgan has committed to our program," Waldorf head coach Brett Schalansky said. "He is an extremely hard worker, has high character, and is willing to do all of the little things that it takes to win games." Wright joined Minnesota mid-season after playing 25 games with the Valley Junior Warriors in Haverhill, Massachusetts. "We are thrilled to welcome Luke to Waldorf and to have him as part of our program," Schalansky said. "He competes hard and plays with a lot of energy, and he will fit well into our lineup. I know that he was a great mid-season acquisition for the Mullets, and he is a big addition for our team as well." The nationally ranked Waldorf women's wrestling team added some new weapons to its already solid lineup on Monday, as four new wrestlers signed letters of intent to compete for the Warriors next season. Nadia Barrientos is a 133-pound wrestler from Hilltop High School in Chula Vista, California. She finished second overall at the San Diego Section Tournament earlier this year, earning her spot at the CIF State Tournament. "I'm pumped to have Nadia join us," Waldorf head coach Tyrese Gilder said. "She will bring another element of toughness and grit to our program as she helps strengthen our lineup in the middleweight range." Ashlyn Doering is a 182-pound wrestler from Redwood Valley High School in Minnesota. She joins the program after becoming the first girls wrestler from Redwood Valley to qualify for state. "I never thought I would be able to wrestle in college," Doering said. "I am very thankful." Julia Lundberg won the individual 135-pound girls state title at North Canyon High School in Phoenix, Arizona, and also won three state titles as a member of the Rattlers track and field team. She will compete for Waldorf at 135 pounds. "It means everything to me," Lundberg said of signing to compete in wrestling in college. "It has always been my dream to compete at a higher level." The fourth and final Waldorf signee was Jessica Salinas, who will wrestle for the Warriors at 215 pounds. She finished this past season just a match short of a state championship trip. "I'm very excited to have Jessica join us," Gilder said. "She will add strength to our upper weight classes and our roster as a whole." Jay Hiscox named new West Hancock boys basketball coach. After more than a decade as an assistant basketball coach, Jay Hiscox is finally getting the chance to lead a program of his own. On Monday night, the West Hancock School Board approved the hiring of Hiscox as the Eagles' new boys basketball coach. Hiscox takes over the program after 11 years as an assistant coach under previous head coach Brian Peterson. "I've always wanted to be the head coach of a program," Hiscox said. "I've put in a lot of years as an assistant, and the timing is right, and the opportunity was right. It all just kind of matched up." This past season, the Eagles finished with a 14-11 record with a 9-7 mark in conference play. Hiscox was a member of the coaching staff when West Hancock made it to the state tournament in 2015, 2016, and 2017. The 2015 state berth was the first time since 1930 that the Eagles had made the state tournament. West Hancock boys basketball had not had a lot of success before Coach Peterson got there, Hiscox said. "I give him all the credit as far as building up the program and building it into a winner and a really competitive squad year in and year out." On April 20th, the West Hancock School Board unanimously decided to reopen the head boys basketball position, which had been held by Peterson since 2008. Peterson was allowed to reapply for the position, but it ultimately went to Hiscox. Peterson finished his coaching tenure with a 161-126 career record over his 12 seasons. "I'm very confident in my ability on the in-game stuff, adjustments, X's and O's," Hiscox said. "It's all the extra stuff that goes along with being a head coach, like media or summer schedules, that are going to take a little bit of time to adjust to. I'm definitely going to lean on Coach Peterson to help me out with that. He'll always be a friend of mine and will definitely be a mentor for me going forward." For the boys program, one goal over the next few years is to match the success of the rest of the West Hancock sports teams. The girls basketball squad is coming off of two consecutive state tournament appearances. The football team won the 2019 Class A state title, and six Eagles boys wrestlers qualified for the state wrestling tournament this past season. "West Hancock is made up of a whole lot of really competitive kids," Hiscox said. "Those kids that set the bar have always done a good job of encouraging those that are coming up behind them to do better than they did. It's a good thing to have. Not a lot of schools have that built into the culture of their schools." A letter to the editor. Why so much faith in Rochester? I'll make it short and simple. Yes, it is true that KIMT puts your faith in Rochester way too much, not Mason City. Yes, they should equal out the difference. It is unfair, even if they have the station, they know what we want now. I still believe, yes, they are putting too much faith in Rochester and nothing else. Signed, Leon Gronwalt, Mason City. A letter to the editor. Let them eat pork that they come get. If indeed the true story about U.S. pork is that our processing capacity is short, export needs must be met even if there is not enough processed pork to fill the shelves domestically, and there is an ever-growing line of market hogs with nowhere to go but a grave, Then, Mr. President, maybe you should contact all your export customers, have them fire up their military cargo planes, and have them meet their product on the hoof in Des Moines. Let them find the means to process. Signed, Bob Freund, Green. Cedar Rapids man sentenced for knowingly giving 3 HIV. A Cedar Rapids man has been sentenced to 26 years in prison after admitting that he knowingly infected 2 women and a minor girl with HIV. Lamont James, 33, was sentenced Monday after pleading guilty to 2 counts of assault while participating in a felony and 4 counts of criminal transmission of an infectious or contagious disease, the Cedar Rapids Gazette reported. James admitted during a court hearing held by phone because of the coronavirus pandemic that he had physical contact with a 13-year-old girl and had sex with 3 other women. The girl and 2 of the women were infected with HIV. The 3rd woman was not. The minor girl reported James to the police when she was 16, according to an affidavit. The plea agreement calls for consecutive sentences of the 5 5-year felony terms and the 1-year serious misdemeanor term for a total of 26 years. Reynolds considers allowing more Iowa public activities. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Tuesday she is considering whether to allow additional activities to resume as her current proclamation prohibiting social, community, recreational, leisure, and sporting gatherings and events of more than 10 people expires next week. We're continuing to see positive trends, and so we're going to continue to monitor that and look for opportunities to continue to bring more businesses online, she said. While Reynolds recently allowed restaurants, fitness centers, malls, hair salons, barbershops, and tanning facilities to reopen with limits on close contact and customer volume, she continued the closure for many other businesses. Those businesses include bars, casinos, movie theaters, bingo halls, bowling alleys, pool halls, arcades, and amusement parks. Her proclamation expires May 27th. State health officials reported more than 300 new positive cases Tuesday and 12 additional deaths, bringing the state totals to 15,296 known positive cases and 367 deaths. Reynolds also said she will ask the federal government for an extension of the order that allows National Guard troops to assist with state coronavirus response missions while being paid with federal funds. An initial extension in the order authorizes their assignment through June, and Reynolds said she plans to seek extension possibly through the end of July. COVID-19 data sharing with law enforcement sparks concern. More than 11 million people have been tested in the U.S. for COVID-19, all with the assurance that their private medical information would remain protected and undisclosed. Yet public officials in at least 2/3 of the states are sharing the addresses of people who tested positive with first responders, from police officers to firefighters to EMTs. An Associated Press review found that at least 10 of those states also share the patients' names. First responders argue the information is vital in helping them take extra precautions to avoid contracting and spreading the coronavirus. But civil liberty and community activists have expressed concerns of potential profiling in African American and Hispanic communities that already have an uneasy relationship with law enforcement. Some envision the data being forwarded to immigration officials. The information could actually have a chilling effect that keeps those already distrustful of the government from taking the COVID-19 test and possibly accelerate the spread of the disease, the Tennessee Black Caucus said in a statement. Sharing the information does not violate medical privacy laws, according to guidance issued by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But many members of minority communities are employed in industries that require them to show up to work every day, making them more susceptible to the virus and most in need of the test. In Tennessee, the issue has sparked criticism from both Republican and Democratic lawmakers, who only became aware of the data sharing earlier this month. The process is simple. State and local health departments keep track of who has received a test in their region and then provide the information to dispatch centers. The AP review shows that happens in at least 35 states that share the addresses of those who tested positive. At least 10 states go further and also share the names. Those states are Colorado, Iowa, Louisiana, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, North Dakota, Ohio, South Dakota, and Tennessee. Wisconsin did so briefly but stopped earlier this month. there have been 287,481 positive cases in those states, mostly in New Jersey. We should question why the information needs to be provided to law enforcement, whether there is that danger of misuse, said Thomas Sens, president of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. He said law enforcement agencies should provide assurances that the information won't be turned over to the federal government, noting the Trump administration's demands that local governments cooperate with immigration authorities. Law enforcement officials say they have long been entrusted with confidential information, such as social security numbers and criminal history. The COVID-19 information is just a continuation of that trend. According to the National Fraternal Order of Police, more than 100 police officers in the United States have died from the coronavirus. Hundreds more have tested positive, resulting in staffing crunches. Many agencies before having this information had officers down, and now they've been able to keep that to a minimum, said Maggie Duncan, executive director of the Tennessee Association of Chiefs of Police. Critics wonder why first responders don't just take precautions with everyone, given that so many people with the virus are asymptomatic or present mild symptoms. Wearing protective equipment only in those cases of confirmed illness is unlikely to guarantee their protection, they argue. In Ohio, Health Director Dr. Amy Acton issued an April 24th order requiring local health departments to provide emergency dispatchers with names and addresses of people who tested positive for the coronavirus. Yet the order also stated that first responders should assume anyone they come into contact with may have COVID-19. That portion of the order puzzles the American Civil Liberties Union. If that is a best or recommended practice, then why the need or desire to share the specific information with first responders, said Gary Daniels, chief lobbyist for the ACLU's Ohio chapter. Duncan said having the information beforehand is valuable because it allows officers to do their jobs better and safer. To use the data, officers aren't handed a physical list of COVID-19 patients. Instead, addresses and names are flagged in computer systems so that dispatchers can relay to officers responding to a call. In most states using the information, first responders also must agree they won't use the data to refuse a call. In some states, the information is erased after a certain period of time. In Tennessee, the data is purged within a month or when the patient is no longer being monitored by the health department, according to health officials and agreements the AP reviewed. In Ohio's Franklin County, which includes the state capital, health officials reported 914 confirmed and probable cases to dispatch agencies in May and April, but removed those names after patients spent 14 days in isolation, said spokeswoman Mitzi Klein. Some are not convinced. The Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition called sharing the medical information deeply concerning, warning that doing so may undermine the trust governments have been trying to build with immigrants and communities of color. Tell us how it's working for you, then tell us how well it's been working. Don't just tell us you need it for your job, said State Representative G.A. Hardway, a Memphis Democrat who chairs the Legislative Black Caucus. The data remains highly sought after by law enforcement. In Pennsylvania, two police unions sued to force local health officials to disclose both patient names and addresses. The lawsuit is still pending. Still, there have been cases of misuse. New Hampshire health officials agreed to start sharing names and addresses in mid-March, but some first responders also informed local leaders of positive cases. State Health Department spokesman Jake Leon said that was a misunderstanding and has been stopped. We have not experienced additional issues, Leon said. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS Short Take from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. If the wisdom on bumper stickers is true, and those with the most toys truly do win, then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they are built to 1/16th or 1/32nd scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education in heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cursing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of US 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.